You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with historian and author Frank Trentman. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
The bridge between the new book, Out of the Darkness, which is about Germany in the last 75 years, and the previous work, which looked at the transformation of consumer culture in the world, the bridge is morality. So one thing that became clear in writing Empire of Things was that there's virtually no time or place in history where consumption, so what people buy and what they do with the things they buy, isn't heavily moralized. So our lifestyle is often treated as a mirror of our virtue or of our sins. And in the course of modern history, there's been a remarkable moral shift in the way that consumption used to be seen as a negative, something that led you astray or undermined authority, status, gender roles, or just wasted money, to something positive, a source of growth or a source of self-fashioning, the way we create our own identity. Of course, at the moment, or in the last few years, the environmental crisis has led to new questions about whether consumption is good or bad. In any case, morality emerged as something I became very interested in, and autumn, winter of 2015 and the so-called refugee crisis, when Germany took in almost 1 million refugees, morality became a very powerful way in which Germans talked about themselves as humanitarian world champions, as one politician called it, welcoming these refugees. Suddenly a penny dropped and I thought, wow, so interesting how this topic is so moralized. And I then realized that there's many other topics, from family to work to saving to the environment, and of course with regard to the German responsibility for the Holocaust and a war of extermination, where German public discourse is heavily moralistic. And so I then became interested in charting that historical process. Consumption is a tricky business, because ultimately, we've moved ourselves into a situation where, on the one hand, we now recognize that things, small things, big things, leisure, sessions, everything from the clothes we buy to makeup or wristwatches or bags or the type of holidays we play, that all those things are an important source of identity. And we believe, or most of us believe, people should have the right and the autonomy to choose the kind of lifestyle they want to have. That makes them themselves, who they want to be. On the other hand, we have the environmental costs of that lifestyle, which is causing havoc with our planet and ultimately with our lives. And so we're caught. We're caught in a social, political acceptance of the freedom to choose, if you want to call it that, and a growing awareness that, you know, the world is heading towards environmental disaster and taking us down with it. We haven't found a way of resolving that ambivalence. Obviously, there are people, climate activists, but also others, economists and so forth, who've come up with very, very radical solutions, from zero growth to, you know, simple living and many others. As a historian who's followed the rise of and transformation of consumption over 500, 600 years, I can assure you that it's too simple to just try and demonize consumption and hope that by just drawing attention to environmental problems, people will somehow reform themselves. I think we have to take seriously that in the course of modernity, consumption has become deeply embedded culturally, socially, politically in our lives. So just sort of waving an alarmist poster will not sort of shock us out of the kind of lifestyle which has become normal for us. I mean, I think that's one thing. The other thing I would say is that, and one thing I came to appreciate when working on Empire of Things, is people tend to confuse or equate consumption with individual choice and motivation or desire. And yes, sure, there's a fair bit of consumption which falls into that category. But from an environmental point of view, a huge amount of our lifestyle, hyper-consumption lifestyle, is not organized or conducted through choice, individual choice, but they're social habits. So think of mobility, you know, it's or domestic comfort. So it's not that in the morning someone just gets up and says, oh, what shall I choose to do this morning? Shall I just have a shower? Shall I have a bath? Shall I do neither or just splash some water on my face? No. I mean, these days, people have a shower as a matter of habit. Some people have two or three showers a day. And similarly, what they have for breakfast, that they have breakfast in the first place, and then how do they get to their leisure activities or their work? There's a car, if they have one, they're used to driving, and that's a habit. So lots of things that cause damage are habitual forms of consumption, and those are not driven by individual choice. They're there because our cities have been planned in a particular way. State and other authorities have built highways, car manufacturers get certain subsidies, there's an infrastructure of gas stations or electric charging points or not, and all those things together create daily patterns of carbon-emitting activities. I think the lesson from that is if you want to tackle environmental consequences, yes, you can talk about choice, but perhaps a more effective way would be to intervene and try and disrupt those habits and plan cities and mobility in different ways that are environmentally friendlier. So you need to think about transforming habits. I think one lesson to take away from this whole story. So obviously, compared to the murderous regime of Nazi Germany, the post-war era, both in West and East Germany, is much better. Certainly by our standards. But the book doesn't try and tell a sort of linear success story. So it's not that we move from the Germans being bad to the Germans being good. In most areas of life, morality works as a form of debate and conflict. So there are serious conflicting views. And one thing that's interesting about the Germans and the book in many ways is that we're dealing with deeply conflicted people. So this is an ongoing process. And to make sense of that, I really worked in two steps. The first was to, I think, recognize purely from working in the archives and reading about various topics, that it's too simple to reduce the question of the remaking of the German people to a confrontation with guilt. The way the book is organized in parts is that I tell a story in a chronological way, but then I also give attention to particular subject matters that are deeply moralized in Germany. And those are money. So the Germans and their money are quite interesting affair, if you want. It's social fairness, justice, and the family. And then it's nature and the environment. And in each of these three, there is a highly idealized version of what the good life should look like. So the book tries to take seriously that this history is not a sort of sudden confrontation with the crimes of the Second World War. It produces its own dynamic and charts out and flows into a number of domains from politics to everyday life. I think there was a certain naivety in many German circles, which assumed that the moment you have an official memory culture in which the Holocaust and the responsibility for the Holocaust is a central source of what it means to be German. The minute you have this memory culture, then problems such as racism or anti-Semitism will just go away. So many commentators and politicians were sort of deeply confused last autumn after the Hamas attacks on Israel on the 7th of October, when suddenly in the following weeks, you had, on the one hand, more or less complete silence in the German population, no show of empathy, no mass demonstrations. And on the other hand, you had a steep rise of anti-Semitic attacks. How could this be? Many people said, didn't we have a successful confrontation of the past? And I think what this confused was that commemoration, public memory, public history, it's all very good and well. And it's important, and I think Germany should take certain pride in that register, but it doesn't automatically translate into everyday life and people's attitude towards German Jews in their midst or towards foreigners, that one doesn't necessarily produce the other. Memory culture and collective identity was radically different in West Germany from that in East Germany. So the West German state in 1949 saw itself constitutionally as the rightful successor of the German Empire before it. And that also included taking on responsibility for certain debts accumulated. With that came a sense of reparation, which meant that under Chancellor Adenauer, the Federal Republic introduced major reparation or compensation payments for German Jewish victims of the Holocaust. So there was a kind of responsibility for historical acts committed by other Germans or earlier generations of Germans. The East German constellation is radically different. East Germany is a communist state, 1949, and the communist leadership saw itself victims of the Nazis. Indeed, many of the communist leaders had sat in concentration camps. So they interpreted the founding of the German Democratic Republic as a kind of historical justice in which the better Germany, as they began to call themselves, communist, German communist resistance, with the help of the Red Army of the Soviet Union, had overthrown fascism. So they had turned themselves from victims into victors in this historical drama. And that meant, in their minds, that they were a radically new state with no obligations towards all the evil that Nazi Germany had committed in the past. And that also meant that East Germany paid no reparations or compensation to Jews. Indeed, it thought it would be foolish to give Jews, who are after all capitalists, money in a new communist state. So you had radically divergent views of historical responsibility with practical consequences in terms of who was a deserving victim. One striking difference in Germany since 2022, so since the Russian attack on Ukraine, is that in the eastern part, so the former GDR, there is very, very strong opposition to the German government sending military support to the Ukraine. There's a strong demand for peace negotiations being really pushed on Ukraine, and many people want a resumption of Russian oil and gas, which, given the geographic location, was arriving first across the Baltic in the eastern parts. So that's a major difference in the ways in which not all East Germans, but a very significant minority who sees themselves as victims of a Western takeover after 1990 is siding with Putin and Russia, because Putin and Russia are also seen as having been unduly victimized by the Western alliance and NATO. So there are many differences remaining. On Israel and Germany, I think it's a very, very complex situation with multiple conflicts and debates sort of crisscrossing each other. But the big picture, I think, is that what we've seen is a very robust and persistent attitude, policies by the German government, which is firmly standing side by side with Israel, with policies that have been very, very careful not to issue any criticism of Israeli military strategy or policies. And on the other hand, by now a majority in the population, which, while recognizing the right of Israel to defend themselves, are either openly critical of the measures and military actions used in that defense, or, and I think that's equally troubling, voices that say, well, what has this got to do with us? The Middle East has always been a mess. Why should we get involved in this in any way? We think Germany should just turn its back on the Middle East and live happily among themselves without concerning themselves too much with international affairs. So you have seen in the last 10 months now a growing divide between official policy, which has made support for Israel a reason of state, and growing concern about the consequences of Israeli policy for the population in Gaza. So Germany is really divided, I would say, on the question of what to do in the conflict in the Middle East. I would like young people to resist the stories they hear from school teachers or career advisors or sometimes from their own parents, where they're being urged to move into particular subjects in engineering or the natural sciences because supposedly that's the only way where there's a future. They should continue their interest in history to consider studying history. I think history is tremendously important. All the topics we've talked about, I mean, contemporary topics from environmental crisis to Gaza to the war in Ukraine, all of those don't make sense if you don't have a sense of history. So history is hugely important, but strangely enough, history and the humanities in the United Kingdom, as in the United States, have come under huge pressure. So we've seen falling student numbers. We've seen jobs being cut or jobs being frozen in history and the humanities. And that's, I think, a real shame because history, like literature and philosophy, continue to be a source of intellectual inspiration and curiosity that don't just make us wiser and more reflective. I think it's also creating the dynamism and creativity we need to confront our present and future challenges. So my main hope is that people will not just continue reading history in terms of reading popular history books or watching history series, but that among the young generations, there will be people who will feel inspired by history and have the ambition to themselves research the past and write about the past. That would be my main hope.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.